We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
On the 4th of November this year, we will be celebrating, some of us anyway, the 250th birthday of Augustus Toplady. A man with a name like Augustus Toplady deserves to be remembered. He must have endured much suffering through the course of his life, I would have thought, just because of his name alone. I'm very glad to say that you don't come across many Augustuses these days, and I've yet to meet a Toplady, other than my wife, of course. And he is remembered often by Hollywood. Not so much directly, but whenever Hollywood want to give the impression of the good old days and the Western world, oh, sorry, not the Western world, but the Cowboys and Indians Westerns, and they get a group of people sitting or standing in a weatherboard church building out in the prairie of Nowheresville, they have them singing one of two hymns. Bringing in the Sheaves is one of them they sing, or the other one they always sing is Rock of Ages, which is the great hymn of Augustus Toplady. 250 years old this year. We'll come to Mr. Toplady and his hymn in a while, but firstly let me thank you about the cards that you filled in last time. You'll see there's different cards you've got in your outline today. Some of them are university church cards because we've run out of campus Bible study cards, but that then gives you the opportunity to tell you about the university church, which meets on Friday nights down at Keith Burrows at 7 o'clock. If you're new in town and you're looking for a student church, that is where it's at, Keith Burrows Lecture Theatre Friday night. But it's a comment card that we want. On the way through the lectures, because there's very little time at the end, if you'll be jotting down any questions or comments you want to be make, I read them all and I appreciate the advice and the comments, the questions that you give and the opportunity for learning. I've actually profited by thinking through some issues that you raised last week, especially about the details of the text of different verses and what they mean, most of which people have put their name on, so we'll be contacting you personally and talking to you about those questions and seeking to go further with you privately. But if you put your name on it anonymous, if you don't put your name on, as if it's anonymous, well then I take in board what you say and to some extent will seek to answer. There are three areas of answers that I thought to raise today, because there are three major issues, if I can summarise the different comments. I'm not going to go through every one every week, because otherwise we'll never actually do anything new. We'll be just always talking about last week's talk. But there are three areas that I think we can summarise the questions so far that have come to us. One is baptism, one is law, and one is hell. So let me give you a quick run through on what the questions are about. They vary from person to person, but they're all of the general, the drift is the same, and something of the answers. On the subject of baptism, if it doesn't guarantee that that you are a Christian, then can you be a Christian without being baptised, is a kind of question that has come. Well, it is abnormal to be a Christian without baptism, as baptism is the initiation into Christianity, but yes, of course you can be a Christian without being baptised. The thief on the cross, I take it, is a Christian Jew. In fact, you can argue that he was the very first Christian, because the basis upon which he was saved was Christ. And he called upon the Christ to remember him when he comes in his kingly power. And people who want him saved under the old covenant, I think, have not understood the Bible properly. That man was not baptised, but was saved. And so was Christian. Historically, of course, for the last 100 and whatever years it is now, the Salvation Army have not baptised any of their members for strange historical reasons that we won't go into now. And I find it fairly difficult to contemplate the possibility that there has not yet been one Salvation Army officer who is Christian, or that their Christianity is in any way defective because they are wearing a uniform instead of being baptised. Theologically, I'd say yes, because of passages like 1 Peter 3:20, where baptism is discussed in terms of not the removal of dirt from the body, but the appeal to God or the pledge to God of a clear conscience through the resurrection of the dead, through the resurrection of Jesus, you are saved. It's not the external rite, but the internal thing that it symbolises, 1 Peter 3:20. And that, of course, is why we got raised the matter last week in chapter 2, because it's not being circumcised externally that makes you a Jew, it's being circumcised in your heart that makes you Jewish. Well, likewise, it's not being baptised externally that makes you Christian, it's being baptised in your heart that makes you Christian. Second area is the subject of law. I suggested to you, coming out of chapter 2 and verse 15, 16 and the like, 14, 15, that the law is not arbitrary. It reflects God's character and therefore it reflects creation. And that is why the Gentiles may know in their hearts, in their conscience, what is right and what is wrong. And that it is right and wrong. That is, I believe, to some extent, in intuitionism, if you want to put it into philosophical terms, because of God. Now, some people then raise the question, well, is that true of all laws? Are any of the laws of the Old Testament just arbitrary? What about the Sabbath law? Is that an arbitrary law, or is that part of creation? And the character of God. I take it's part of creation and the character of God. That's what Genesis 1 is saying, or Genesis 2, 1 to 4. I think you'll see it in life. The Russian Revolution, of course, brought in the 10-day working week. It was one of the very first things that they threw away and went back to a 7-day working week. Modern capitalism is bringing it in. My friends of mine who are working in some very capitalistic centres, such as Singapore, are finding it very hard to find a day off. And I think in the long term you will see societies that operate without time off burn out their workers and fracture their societies and their family life completely. We are not made to work. That is not the sole end and purpose of mankind in the purposes and character of God. And taking a day off every week is a very important part of right and proper living. Being a workaholic is a dreadful captivity. Whether it's through the left under the revolution or whether it's through the right under capitalism, it's equally a slavery that we must resist. And they say, what about other laws, Levitical laws, food laws? Well, you've got to look at the context, the rhyme and the reasons for those laws, but they do reflect God's character of justice, equity and holiness. And they are part of God in his ways. Should we impose these laws, then, comes the other question, on non-Christians? Well, no, the word impose captures you out terribly, doesn't it? I mean, what are you going to impose on anybody? We're not called to impose the law of God upon people. The first century world in which the New Testament is written, the Christians didn't have any chance of imposing anything on anyone. But they never worked towards an imposition like that. We are to persuade, we are to pray for, but we are not to impose, and you cannot bring Christianity with a rifle or a sword or anything like that. That cannot be done and must never be done. It will always be false Christianity if people are forced to it. However, it is right to persuade. If by impose you include the right to persuade people, it's certainly right to persuade people to these things. And if by impose you mean, should I vote in such a way, if I'm given the democratic option of voting, well, yes, there's nothing wrong. Everyone is imposing their point of view. Every minority group in the community is imposing their point of view in the ballot box next Saturday. That's what it's all about. And Christians are not excluded or unable to vote in the people that they would like, who undoubtedly will bring laws to bear which will reflect characters. And some of the impositions of Christian governments in the past seem to me to have been a perfectly appropriate thing. The abolition of suti in India, that is the burning of widows on their husband's funeral pyre, seemed to me a very good thing that I'm very glad the Christians did. They abolished it. It was a wonderful thing, and the glamorisation of Hinduism in our Eastern world needs to take account that it has been sanitised by Christianity of some of its worst elements. The whole removal of the caste system in that land and the rejection of putting a whole group of people down as untouchables. Christianity opposed and brought laws to bear in that land when Christians had some control in India to stop such a thing taking place. Christians imposed their view on slavery on the whole world, thanks to Mr. Wilberforce and his friends, so as to remove slavery. I think they're good things to do. I think they reflect the character of God. I think they reflect the character of this world. The way in which the Christians have actually sought to outlaw cannibalism in much of the world seems to me a good thing. So, yes, to some extent, I'm for imposing, but only imposing legally, only imposing within the structures that you can. and not imposing as a normal method of trying to bring the gospel of Jesus to other people. The third is much more important area, because it reflects a little bit more on what the passages have all been about so far. That's hell. I'm glad that you've asked these questions, and there are a lot of questions in this area, because it shows a real concern for justice and fairness, which shows that God is still at work in your life. And it also shows a concern for God being just and fair, which again shows the work of God in your life, and I appreciate it and hear that what you're saying. There are two unjust examples of hell which you use. Different ones use slightly different. One is this: you tell one lie and for that you have to spend all of eternity in hell. It doesn't seem that the punishment fits the crime. The second is you have no knowledge or absolutely minimal knowledge of God, and yet you are held responsible to him and must go to hell when you really weren't given a chance. Now, the passage is addressing and answering some things of these questions. So let me try and summarise and clarify what I've said. We don't want to give the whole three talks all over again, so I'm just going to summarise them. But you keep asking if the summary hasn't caught up what's been said, or you're still disagreeing, or you're still questioning it. You keep coming and asking us over coffee outside in your cards again. God will act justly, and he will only give people what they deserve. It misses the point to say that one lie leads to hell. A lie is a symptom of the disease. It's not the symptom that gets you to hell, it's the disease. What is the disease? The disease is rejection of God. The disease is to say, I do not want God in my universe. And the punishment of hell is that you are given a universe without God. And so you get exactly what you ask for. The lie is only a symptom of that rebellion against God. You reject God, you will live without him, and you'll die without him. But then again, you rejected him. What of those who have never heard? Well, I'm saying everybody has heard. Well, what about those who have heard minimally? Well, they're not judged by what they know. No one is judged by what you know. You are only judged by what you do with what you know. But it's not even judged with what you do with what you know, it's judged with by what you do with what you can know. You see, the Jews had the law and ignored it. If a Gentile who has not the law obeys it, then he will be credited as having obeyed it, even though he doesn't have it. It's not owning the knowledge, having the knowledge, that is the basis of the judgment. It's what you do with the knowledge. But importantly, you are held accountable for ignoring. You're not held accountable for ignorance. If you cannot possibly know, then you're not held accountable for that. But if you can know, and it's completely reasonable and proper that you should know, if the facts are staring you in the face and you close your eyes, well then you are held accountable for ignoring what you can know. Now, friends, at that point, it is exactly the same as the justice system in operation here in New South Wales, which, of course, has come out of a Christian way of thinking. That is, ignorance is no excuse in the law. Why? Because the law is public. It's gazetted publicly. It's enacted in Parliament publicly. It's declared by the governor publicly. It's the citizen's responsibility to know what the law says. There's no point driving down the wrong side of Anzac Parade at 150 kilometres an hour and saying to the policeman when he finally catches you, I didn't know the speed limit. That is no excuse, you see, ignorance, because the law is public. You are responsible for not ignoring the law. What may be known of God is public. If you ignore what is public about him, then you are held responsible for what you do with what you can know. It's exactly the same justice system we accept and operate. It's very important that we're concerned for God's justice. And so I'm glad we think through the issue and ask and work and make sure we're clear on it and make sure that it's right. And that's what the Bible is saying. However, sometimes, of course, people are not concerned about God's justice or about worrying about people in deepest, darkest Africa, who they always get mentioned from, What they're trying to do really is excuse and rationalise and avoid facing up to the God they already know. And rather than facing up to their own ignoring of God, their own guilt, what they do is try and shift the blame on God. Friends, if you think for a moment that God is going to judge the people in deepest, darkest Africa who only have a minimal piece of information about God, then what do you think he will do for us who have every opportunity in the world? Don't shift the blame onto God. Face up to your own responsibilities. Well, that turns to today's study. For today, we'll come to a great purple passage of the Bible, verses 21 to 31 of chapter 3. And today we'll come to what Paul talks about in chapter 1, verse 16, that is the power of God. For today we come to hear about the righteousness that is from God, as opposed to a righteousness that is from ourselves. A righteousness from God, which is the power of God. Today, I hope and expect that some of you will actually experience the power of God. Some of you, for the first time, will experience the power of God. That is not, we're going to have a magic show. We're not going to do miraculous signs here. You won't get any weird sensations. You won't see somebody lighting up with their hair standing on their head and their eyes turning orange and their heads revolving on their shoulder blades. That is not experiencing the power of God. God doesn't do that kind of thing to people, by and large. But we are going to experience the power of God, because what God does is transform people personally through the experience that comes from the words of God. And what I say, not everyone will hear what I say. Some will fall asleep. Some will think of calculus. Not everyone will understand what is said. It's all so new to them. Not everyone will agree or believe what is said. That's the way it is with speaking. But there will be some amongst us who the Spirit of God is opening our minds to understand, and they will see the implications for themselves, and in seeing the implications for themselves will become right with God in a way that they never have been before. And when you become right with God like that, you experience God's power. He transforms not only your relationship with him, but your relationship with others and your relationship with yourself. And not only the moment, but actually your lifetime gets changed by it. It is very powerful what is going to be taking place. Which is why we prayed in the first place, Leon led us in prayer, that I might speak the truth accurately, and that God might help us in our hearing, in understanding and evaluation. It's also why we give out the card, so that you can be asking questions about it, because especially if you are someone who this day is beginning to see the righteousness that comes from God, or beginning to see your need for such a righteousness, that you can get help. How you get help is very simple. You put your name and address there, and you tick the box if you've got it, like it says, I'd like some spiritual help, or you make some comment or question like that, and you say, I want to know more about this. Because it really is so important that we are more than happy to make time to meet with you privately and talk with you further about it, and to help you to know how you can be right with God. Well, where do we start? Verse 21 starts with the words, but now, which puts it in contrast to what has preceded. In contrast, I believe, to 1:18 through to 3:20. In contrast with man's problem with sin, his solution for sin, which is a failed solution, and God's problem with sin. Really in contrast to everything that has gone already beforehand. So a lot of today we're going to be reviewing chapters 1 to 3 so as to get this in context. This is the kind of study where you paint all the backdrop, and when you've got all the backdrop there, then we'll paint in the key figure right in the front, and the foreground will make sense because of the background, I hope. What is man's problem with sin? If you don't like the word man there because you think it's sexist, do change it, won't you? Because I think it most likely could be improved now that I've looked at it, and it's easy to change it. Just change it to my. What is my problem with sin? First thing about sin is that it's universal. That's the first thing that chapter 3 has been arguing for us. It's not a phenomenon restricted to one group like the Gentiles, nor to the Jews. We have all failed. All of us have failed to live our life for our Maker, to live our life for which we have been made. And so the problem with sin is God's reaction to our sin, namely his wrath or anger. It comes in the first place, partially, chapter 1, verse 18 through to 32, partially, because what God does is he just gives the world up. He gives us up to do our own thing. But yet he remains in contact with the world. He doesn't give us up totally and fully. He just gives us up partially. And so he still sends the rain and the sun. The signs of God's goodness is here, and yet the world is a confused state of justice and injustice because the rain falls on the just and the unjust. It's not just those who are bad who get the hailstorms, but, well, I know there's a lot on the North Shore, weren't there? Maybe so. Now, the world we live in then, you see, is a world that has partial justice in it, partial wrath from God in it, for it has gone amok. But yet evil is not fairly dealt with, so some monstrous acts seem to go unpunished, while the apparently innocent victims seem to suffer intensely. However, God promises that the day will come when there will be a permanent and full wrath and justice. His day of justice, his day of wrath is coming when each person will be judged individually on their merits, by truth, by what they have in fact done. Which leads many people today to presume on God's patience. They presume that God's not angry. They presume that God will not pay them for their deeds. They presume that there will be no day of reckoning. For they have done things and got away with it. And when you do things and get away with it, you presume that you will always be able to get away with it. Even though the sickness and death and disasters of the world warn us that everything's not right with this world, they trumpet the warning from God that the judgment day is coming, the message doesn't seem to reach our presuming ears. Even though our own yearnings can be for justice and truth and righteousness and equity and fairness, yet our own yearnings do not reach our presuming ears. God's wrath, which we can have a foretaste of in this disordered and fallen and evil world, God's wrath is coming. And our response to it is to invent solutions. For each of us knows something of guilt. Each of us knows that what the Bible is saying about sin is true of me. For each of us have lied. Each of us have failed to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, mind. That's the biggest commandment, therefore it's presumably the biggest sin. Each of us have been at times affected by jealousy and envy, by rivalry, by ill thoughts towards each other, by slander, by gossip. Each of us, yes, we are really in trouble if God's day of judgment is coming. Our solution is morality. We think by elevating rules and regulations, the do's and don'ts of life, that somehow we could lift ourselves up by our bootstrings. We can find a righteousness from within ourselves, that our good deeds might somehow cancel out our bad deeds, that when all is said and done at the end of the day, when God looks at us, he can say, well, you are 51% good. Come on, that will do me. That's all right. Or it may not be a mean like that, it might be more a median thing. You know, well, you're in the top 49%, so that's all right. I mean, that's how we got into university, that's how we'll get into heaven. You no longer have to actually do a good score anymore, you just have to beat the competition. That's all that matters, isn't it? And so it's good to hang around with rotten people. We think that by obeying the Ten Commandments, or whatever it may be, the Sermon on the Mount, preferably something we haven't read too frequently, we will be all right with God by the works of the law that we will be established as righteous. Because as a solution, it's dreadful, isn't it? Because it's full of boastfulness. It's like those appalling joggers' morality. Joggers and some environmentalists have got an appallingly arrogant, boastful morality, isn't it? On the back of the cars, you see the big sign saying, I made it. It's appalling arrogance, isn't it? Especially for people like me who didn't. We keep feeling it, you see, because it's all about my achievements, how good I am. That's the key to it. It's like that other bumper sticker that you see on old bomb cars, you know, when you get up close to them and it says, you may think this is a bomb, but at least it's in front of you. Now, it's like that with our morality. You say, well, I know I'm not perfect, I know I'm not really tops, but I'm better than my next door neighbour. You should see what he does. As if somehow what he does justifies what I have done. It's why we hate Christians in the end. Because when they say, I'm a Christian, it sounds so arrogant, because they're saying, I really am fairly good, I am a moral person. And it's either they're true, it's that they are moral and good people, to which means they're very arrogant, or it's untrue, to which means they're hypocritical. Either way, they are unpleasant people, Christians like that. It's also why inside, you can never be sure of God's acceptance, can you? Because if you think the way in which you get there is by doing well, well, you go through all the insecurities you did when you were going through the HSC. Will it be good enough? It was a terrible year, wasn't it? As you lived in the anxiety and those dreadful assessments kept coming around and you saw more and more marks that you were losing. And so you knew that 500 was not a starter, and then you knew that 480 really looked fairly dim, and then you knew that 470 was not really, and then you knew that 400 was going to be a problem, and then you knew that university may be in question. But you're here, and then you forget about it. Well, it's like that with God and heaven. You see, if you've got to be good enough, how good is good enough? And every time you fail, if you've at all got any sensitivity, you say, well, it's not very perfect, and maybe heaven's not so perfect, and I'll squeeze in, but what happens in the years to come if I continue in what I've done in the past? And what about that big one I did? Chapter 3, verse 20 assures us that morality, law-keeping, the Jewish form of it, is really a failure. No one will be declared righteous in God's sight by obeying the law. What the law does is makes us conscious of sin. What the law doesn't do is enable us to keep God's standards. The law is powerless. Its only power lies in condemnation. It does nothing to save you. We as humans are very high in principle and low in performance. So here is the problem that we have so far. All who sin face God's wrath. All do sin. Therefore, all face God's wrath. We hope the law will somehow save us, but no one is saved by the law. What the law does is condemn us. What the law does is make us conscious of our sinfulness. The whole of humanity has a problem, friends, for we are born into this world on the way to hell. And because everyone else is going the same direction, we often don't even notice where we're going. But if we have a problem, God has a problem also. God's problem is with our sin. You see, his response to sin is wrath and anger. Not losing your temper. He doesn't do his lolly or something like that. It's a just and slow anger. It's one that actually weighs what is done very carefully and only brings the punishment to bear because it is right to do so. And it's also slow because God, of his nature and character, is full of mercy and graciousness and kindness and wants to save. He didn't create the world in order to destroy it. He created the world in order to enjoy it, in order that it might go on. And it's a great love of God and compassion for God that he is angry with the world. Remember, as I suggested a couple of weeks ago, that the opposite of love is indifference. It's not anger. God's anger comes out of his love. He hates to see the way we've mucked up his world. He hates to see the way we've mucked up each other. He hates to see the way in which we've mucked up ourselves. It is God's compassionate concern for the world that leads him to be angry. But it's also that compassion, that concern for the world, that means that he wants to save people. He wants to rescue the situation. But there's the problem. You see, in delaying his day of wrath so as to give people time for repentance, so as to give time for forgiveness, so as to give time for a change, in delaying it, some sin goes unpunished. And all sin are not dealt with equitably. People are not given yet what they deserve. People kill, lie, they pillage, they lust, they maim, and nothing happens to them, it would seem. They die in old age in comfort, whereas other people, the victims very often are. Where is the love of God? Where is the justice of God? Here, friends, is that problem now. I've put it in slightly different terms. The problem that you can pick up in nearly every atheist manual on Christianity. If God is all-powerful, if God is all-loving, why is there evil in the world? That's the problem, isn't it? That's expressed from the point of view of the philosophers. But the Bible deals with these problems. It deals with them in their terms, of course, in its own terms. And here is God's problem. How can he forgive? How can he pardon? How can he let the guilty go free? How can he do it on the last day? That is, how can God ever justify the guilty? See, God delays in order to give mercy an opportunity to repent. But in the end, his day of judgment must come when everything will be fixed up. But if everything is fixed up, everyone is lost, for everyone is guilty. How can God justify the guilty? See, there are two kinds of dreadful injustices in the world, aren't there? One is when you punish the innocent. That's a dreadful thing. Someone who doesn't do the crime gets sent off to prison for 10 years. That's awful, isn't it? The other is when you don't punish the guilty. When someone does the crime and you say, well, go home, it's all right, doesn't matter. They're equally guilty. Now, God will punish the guilty, that's great, but the guilty is everybody. And God doesn't want to punish. God doesn't want to destroy. He has made. How can God, who is just, justify the guilty? For when he lets the guilty go free, then what's he saying? Well, he's saying that your sin didn't matter. It really was irrelevant. Or he's saying, I too am a sinner, because I am an unjust judge who says, yes, your sin doesn't matter, but I like the colour of your hair. Come on in. That can't be it, can it? Do you see God's problem? It's a very real one. If he is to act impartially with no special deal for friends, that's awful, isn't it? The other is, when you don't punish the guilty. When someone does the crime and you say, well, go home, it's all right, doesn't matter. They're equally guilty. Now, God will punish the guilty, that's great, but the guilty is everybody. And God doesn't want to punish. God doesn't want to destroy. He has made. How can God, who is just, justify the guilty? For when he lets the guilty go free, then what's he saying? Well, he's saying that your sin didn't matter. It really was irrelevant. Or he's saying, I too am a sinner, because I am an unjust judge who says, yes, your sin doesn't matter, but I like the colour of your hair. Come on in. That can't be it, can it? Do you see God's problem? It's a very real one. If he is to act impartially with no special deal for friends, he must forgive everybody, which would be no justice at all. Or he must forgive some people, that's no justice. Or he must forgive nobody, which is justice, but it means sin has victory. It means the destruction of God's universe. One of the most famous Australians, who most Australians don't know of because his fame is around the world rather than in Australia, but it's here too, is a man called Paul White, a doctor who wrote many, many, many books that are translated all around the world in hundreds of languages and published millions and millions of copies. Comics, he has written, cartoons, children's stories, adult stories, and one of the most enjoyable books I've ever read is his autobiography. He writes, towards the end of it, about a friend of his, the Deputy Commissioner of Police, Mr. W.J. Lawrence, who was not only a friend, but also a patient. One Sunday, on the way home from church, Dr. White was booked for speeding, doing 42 miles per hour in a 35 miles per hour zone. It was some years ago. The next day, a policeman turned up with a letter, turned up at Dr. White's home with a letter from the assistant, the Deputy Commissioner of Police, his friend. It said, "Dear Paul, I see you were booked for driving at 42 miles per hour and that you admitted your guilt. I could not strike your name off the report. That would have been unjust and illegal." You see, you might be a friend of the judge, but the judge just can't rub your name out because you're a friend. For if that is the case, then there is no justice in the world, is there? That cannot be the case. If you are guilty before God, you deserve to be condemned by God. And if you have not loved the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, then you have broken the first and greatest commandment, then you are the greatest of sinners. We don't have to go down the second one, loving your neighbour as yourself. Well, that brings us then to the passage today and God's solution for sin. But to help you understand God's solution for sin, there's a few technical terms that are used in this passage. They come from different places. The first one comes from the law courts. It's the word right or just. It comes, it's two English words, but only one Greek word. And it comes in a whole series of different ways. It can be righteous, righteousness, right, or it can be just, justice, justify, justification. To justify is to acquit. It's to declare a person free from penalty, or it's to declare a person right with the court, right with the judge. It is a legal term from the courts, from the law courts. And you see it in our passage today, verse 21, "But now a righteousness, a justification from God, apart from the law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify." This righteousness which comes from God through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference. Verse 24, "And are justified freely by his grace." Verse 26, "He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time, so that the just and might be justifies." That's the word that's throughout our passage. It is the declaration by the judge that you're right with him. The second one comes from the slave markets, and that's to redeem or redemption. It is the idea of purchasing freedom of somebody or something, usually somebody in the slave markets, of course. Or to ransom. We still use the word in the context today, not of slave markets, but of hijacking. You ransom someone. Or of kidnapping, the same. Or in the pawnbroker, where you get your watch back out of the pawnbroker, you say you redeem your watch. You buy it back out of captivity. It is the word that occurs there in verse 24, "and are justified, declared right with the judge, freely by his grace, through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ." The third area of technical term comes from the temple, and it's sacrifice, and indeed a sacrifice of atonement. To atone is to make amends, or to make reparation for wrongdoing or injury. So someone lends me their watch for campus Bible study, and as I finish off the campus Bible study, I drop their watch on the ground and just stick my foot right on it and smash it. Now, to atone for my crime, I need to apologise and say sorry, and if it was your watch, you would want me also to replace it, wouldn't you? For me to make the sacrifice that would be necessary to do it. And if I did replace it, and if I did apologise, then presumably your anger will have been turned aside. You'll say, "Well, that's all right, that's okay now." If I only apologise, there's every chance your anger wouldn't have been turned aside. If I only pay it back and don't actually apologise, again, your anger may not be turned aside. Or indeed, you could be an unjust person and say, "Philip, you've got to give me two watches instead of the one." The sacrificial system of God was God's statement of what satisfies him. But it was always strange because he was satisfied with the death of a lamb in the place of a human. Never really made sense logically, but that is what is spoken of in verse 25, where it talks about God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood being shed, that is, the blood of a sacrificial lamb being shed. The other two technical terms I haven't got up on the overhead are very simple ones. Grace, and they come often, grace means generosity. Right? It's a free, unmerited gift. It's generosity. And faith means to rely or to depend or to trust. It's not a religious term, it's not a feeling, and it's not an experience. It is relying, depending, trusting, things that you do every day of the week, hundreds and hundreds of times. You trust people, you trust chairs, you trust bus drivers, you rely upon the public transport system. I mean, the incredible things, quite irrational people do. Because faith can be very rational and very irrational, depending what you're putting your faith in. Now, they're the technical terms. Let's look at this passage, because God's solution is, in a word, Jesus. Jesus is God's solution to man's problem and to God's problem. To explain it, we'll need to turn to each of those areas, the law, the slave, and the temple, as Paul does here. You see, he talks about a righteousness that comes from God now, right? As opposed to the righteousness that we tried to get from ourselves. The declaration from God that's got nothing to do with the law, although it's not incompatible with the law. The law bears testimony to it. This righteousness that comes not through law-keeping, but comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. That is how we are now going to be declared right by the judge, through Jesus. The same thing said down there in verse 26. He did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. God is the one, he is the one who declares right those who have faith in Jesus. It's God's legal decision that I am right with him. He is saying Philip Jensen is all right with me. And he says to those who have faith in Jesus, you're all right with me. Now why? How is this not just favouritism again? How does it make sense that he should now say, okay, these ones are all right with me? The second image, slavery. Verse 24. Pick it up in verse 23. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. The way God was to do this was to pay the penalty to free us. He paid the redemption price. He purchased us. We're entrapped by our sin. We're entrapped by his wrath. We're entrapped by justice. But God paid the penalty. What is the penalty? We are redeemed through Jesus. A redemption that came by Jesus. Verse 22. That is how the redemption... But how does the redemption come by Jesus? Well, the answer is verse 25. Because God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. That by the death of Jesus, the captives may go free. Because God's anger was turned aside by God bearing the penalty himself. His blood was shed in my place. He was executed on my behalf. God was in Christ paying the penalty for me. And the penalty having been paid for me, God could now look at me and say, the debt is paid. Let him go. He is all right with me. I come back to Paul White and his friend, the police commissioner. Dear Paul, I see that you are booked for driving at 42 kilometres per hour and that you admitted your guilt. I couldn't strike your name off the report. That would have been unjust and illegal. But I could and did pay your fine. You will see the analogy clearly as one Christian to another. God cannot wipe away our sin and say sin doesn't matter. But God can pay for the sin himself. And the sin having been paid for, the court now declares that person is in good standing with us. God is the judge who pays the penalty for the criminal. Augustus Toplady was in a great storm, and as he was in this storm, he walked past this big rock, and the rock had a big crack in it. It was cleft, and so he got in this cleft in the rock and wasn't affected by the storm. People could have valued that the other day, eh? Get out of the hail that way. While he's in that, he sees the analogy for what Christ is all about. For that is what Christ is, and that's what his hymn is about. The rock of ages has been cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. The water and the blood from your riven side which flowed be of sin the double cure. Not the labours of my hands can fulfil the law's demands. Could my zeal no respite know, could my tears forever flow. All for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. Nothing in my hand I bring. Simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress. Helpless look to thee for grace. Foul I to thy fountain fly. Wash me, Saviour, or I die. While I draw this fleeting breath, when my eyelids close in death, when I soar through tracks unknown, see thee on thy judgment throne, rock of ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. It's a fabulous hymn, really. Next time you hear it on an old Western movie, join in the singing of it. It's a magnificent hymn. For he has understood what this passage is about. That in Jesus I am hidden from the storm of God's wrath. There's nothing I could do of myself by which I could save myself. But what God has done for me means my salvation. Do you see how that solves God's problem? Verse 26, God demonstrates his own justice while justifying the ungodly. Do you see how it solves man's problem? Because my crime is paid for. I am righteous, not because of my law-keeping, not because I'm good, not because I'm circumcised, but because God is merciful and gracious to me and has paid the penalty on my behalf. I am right with God, even though I know I am evil. And therefore I can face my evil deeds. I don't have to run away from them. I don't have to hide. I don't have to pretend that I'm anything other than what I am, rotten. Because God has dealt with my rottenness. And I can be assured of eternal life because it doesn't rely upon me passing any standard. God has done it already for me. And so look at our response. It's not but. In fact, if you have a look at verse 21, you see it starts with but. So I think we should be.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.